Hi, I'm Liz Fair, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me today in the Zoom room is singer, songwriter, author, two-time Grammy nominee, Ms. Liz Fair. Hello, Liz. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Pat?
I am good. Now, we're both in California, correct?
Yes.
I am in Woodland Hills, California, and you're by the beach.
Yes.
As it should be. How long have you lived in California?
20 years.
20 years. So you moved here in 2000? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Boy, I'm good at math. 2020 minus 20, 2000. I moved here in 1995, so I've been here for 25 years. Do you find that since you live here, because you grew up in Chicago, and I grew up in Pennsylvania, and then I moved to Chicago. I lived in Chicago 6 years before I moved here. And now that I live in California, I call it California bones, because if it gets to be below 60 degrees, I'm freezing.
Absolutely. When I go home, it's just, I don't understand how it can be that cold.
I don't get it either.
Especially this time of year, there's something particularly, you know, I mean, I know that it gets worse in January, February, when everyone has to deal with the gray.
Yeah.
But at least by March, it's kind of warming up. But like right around now, it is just brutal. That wind chill in Chicago, unbelievable.
When we don't have a pandemic and I have to drive my daughter to high school, I will go out and warm the car up in the morning in Southern California.
Here in California?
Here in California. Because it could be 40 degrees at 7 in the morning. I'm not going out in that, Liz.
I have been known to bundle up like as if it's below zero out here just to take a walk. You know, like, well, you got to be careful with the wind chill, which is, you know, negligible out here. But
you have to bundle up and then you have to put sunscreen on. You have to do both of those things all at the same time to protect ourselves.
Yeah, right.
Liz, before we get started, what question are you sick of answering or sick of being asked?
Sick of answering. Well, right now it's like women in rock.
Oh, it's the worst.
I've been obviously sort of taking a feminist perspective since the beginning. And so sometimes it gets tiresome to have to be, I guess, you know, honestly, the thing that I like the least are weak questions, like big open-ended questions. Like, tell me, how do you feel about your career now as opposed to the beginning of your career? And I don't really have specific answers for that. You know, like, right. How can I summarize the last 30 years for you? You know, I can't really. So the question I'm most tired of answering is probably somehow like people that are late to the game about women in rock and I'm supposed to represent all females. Mm-hmm. Or just, you know, how do you feel about the beginning of your career? You know, that kind of thing. Open-ended stuff like that.
Do you think people ask you that question because you still look very young? I doubt that people were asking Chrissy Hynde that question because she would punch them in the face.
Well, right. I don't punch people in the face, so maybe they can get away with it. I just think it's lazy journalism. I think it's just they don't want to do the work of summarizing the last 30 years of my career, so they want me to do it.
Right.
Or they don't want to have to get into women in rock or wade into that ring and get slugged out, so they want me to do it. Like, I just consider it lazy.
When does that end? When does a question like that end? I mean, we've had women in rock forever. I mean, even if you want to include, you know, Aretha Franklin in rock.
It's never going to end per se, I doubt. But I think it's too broad. I don't like broad questions. Broad questions of any nature are too much to put on someone else. Like, if I could be, you know, when you Google someone for a quote, you're looking for Mark Twain quote or something. Like, if I had those, I'd put them up there. You know what I mean? If I had like the pithy summary for everything that's happened in the last 35 years, but the journalist doesn't. So why would I?
That must just drive you crazy then when you're in an interview. Because as soon as you hear a question like that, I would imagine you're out of it. You're out of the interview. You're like, I don't even care about this anymore. I mean, that's how I would be.
Yeah, they haven't done what they're supposed to do.
Right.
They haven't done it and they want me to do it for them.
Well, now the pressure's on. By asking you this question, now the pressure's on me.
Just ask me what you actually want to know.
I will. I will. First of all, this is your first book. There's no... this is all you. There's no co-author on this. Many times when I pick up a rock autobiography, there's a co-author. So every word in here, these are yours. You didn't have any help with this. You wrote this.
I mean, I did have help. I had an editor and I had my agent and then I had a copywriter, but they, you know, my editor and everybody is like, we want your voice. We want your voice, which I have been a writer for a long time. I've just been a music lyricist as opposed to prose. And what you're holding in your hand was written in about 2 years. But before that, I was trying to write fiction, like actual fiction. So I did that quietly and privately for about 10 years and really was not very, you know, I was shocked at how much harder it was than I expected. So I had private training before I actually attempted my memoir. But it's still, writing is so fun and challenging and everything. And I love the fact that when I'm writing, I don't have to ask an engineer to do something or a producer if I can do something or a label if I can get money to do something. You know, like, I can just make it the way I want to make it.
You can just do it. Just
it's so, yeah, I love that about it.
And I'll jump around a little bit. So is this what you were doing in the years between Fun Style and your single Good Side? Is this what those 10 years were? You were not only writing this book, which took you 2 years, but you were looking to write fiction.
I was very serious about it. I didn't want to talk about it because it takes a while to feel confident.
Right.
As, you know, someone in a different, you're not good at first.
Right.
You have to overcome self-doubt because what you can imagine, just like starting in any career, just what you imagine you'll be like is not at all what you end up being like in a concrete fashion. Like, you have to put in the 10,000 hours, basically. And, you know, maybe I shaved in there under the 8,000 hour. You know what I mean? Like, there's room for improvement. But I felt confident enough to tackle memoirs. I felt confident and excited to put it out. I wasn't... You know, I was scared, but a lot of what I was scared about was the revealing nature of my memoirs. It wasn't so much the writing itself. At that point, I had written and had it critiqued and written and had it critiqued and written and had it critiqued by then enough that I felt like I was a writer. So there was a lot of things I was nervous about when I put that book out, but I had already proved to myself that I wanted to do this. I enjoyed doing this and I had a facility for it.
Let me ask you this, because I know that you have a son. Is he 22?
God, he's almost 24.
He's almost 24. So when you're writing a book like Horror Stories and you know that he might read it, how does that influence how you're writing? Like, you know, I don't know that I would want to write down everything that I did and hand it over to my 20 and 16 year old and have them read what dad I'm sure my wife would feel the same way. So I guess you just have to just not care that if he reads it or sees it.
That's a great question. Excellent question.
Ta-da.
It is very challenging to want to be an authentic and provocative writer, either in music or in, you know, literary, in the literary sense. I have already sort of broken that barrier long before he was born. If you think about a song like Flower, you know, when I was 26, that already overshot the mark. Like, the people, I think I am in a unique position where my close friends and family either don't read it,
okay,
or don't comment on it. You know, I've gotten away with my parents not being particularly thrilled about me being in rock and roll, you know? So there was like, I enjoyed a little bit of a protective veil, as my ex-husband, the father of my son, told him, like, just don't read it. You know, like, it works out better for me, because I don't think you can make, I can't make anything worth reading without being, without challenging myself in the honesty department.
Yes.
I don't think, I did encounter after that book came out a couple of people that were hurt by what I wrote. Mm-hmm. And I just took it on the face and we worked it out, and everybody's fine now and everyone's happy and it's all mended. But I don't think it's easy to be close with someone who does this like I do. And most of my close friends and family, like my personal life, you would find a stark demarcation between the Liz Phair person and the person I am at home. You know, like to my son, I'm mom.
Right.
And he doesn't interface with my rock and roll career very much at all. Doesn't feel weird about it. I've asked him. I've been like, we had to, because we were recording songs, he had to be my engineer during the pandemic.
Okay.
He had to figure out, we had to do this sort of FaceTime with professionals to help him figure out how to work Logic or Pro Tools. And he's been amazing at it. I almost see it as like an apprenticeship. Like,
that's
he's
cool.
An able-bodied human who's stuck at home here with me. And so like, he can't go out and work in the world at the moment because he needs to like find it. He's the kind of person that would have to put a lot of foot traffic into it. And he's doing all this stuff with me, learning how to do technical things. And we were recording a song that had some lyrics in it.
Sure. Liz Phair lyrics, the lyrics that we are.
He has like somehow magically disassociated himself from whatever I say or do that way. And it does. And I'm like, I feel a little weird about this. How are you feeling about this? Like, you don't deserve to have to do this with me right now. And he's like, I don't care. He really, you can ask him and later on he may have a different answer,
yeah.
But every time I've asked him about it, he doesn't care at all. He's an artist himself.
Now, if you're feeling this way, how are you able to really give it the best performance and really sell it if you're a little bit concerned that your son's in the room and if he's engineering, it's right in his ears. He's really as close to it as you're ever going to get. So
maybe it's like in our natures. Maybe running through our bloodline is my mother was an art historian and was a docent at the Art Institute of Chicago. So she took me around to see all sorts of paintings.
Sure.
And maybe they're paintings and maybe they're in a museum and there's a remove. I don't think she thought of me doing it. But her love of art encompasses provocative art and challenging art and all sorts of stuff that, you know, in polite society would be considering disruptive.
Right.
So I knew from the beginning that people did that. And if you were going to be good, you had to do that. You know, you challenge the culture, you challenge the way we perceive things. And so in my family, there's an understanding that art is art and life is life.
That's good. That's good. And then, so when you're saying when your parents might not have been happy with your rock and roll success or maybe lyrics that you wrote, it's a little bit on your mom too, because she exposed you to some things. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this art.
It's not on her. It's not like, it's really, like, I don't think.
But
she
you know what I mean? I mean, if you see certain art when you're a certain age, you're like, you know, and then you're more open to things.
It's true. It's true. If you're going to raise a creative child, you cannot control the ways in which that child is going to ricochet off of what you. But does any family have a lock on that? Like, think about the kids that get into serious addiction, or they have, you know, there's all sorts of problems that can.
That's
you
true.
Can't control it.
That's true.
I think more people should get over this idea that art is threatening or art is upsetting. It's the place in my life where I'm free to do whatever and say whatever that I wouldn't naturally do in life. Like, I don't live every song the way I wrote it.
Right.
And it is my freedom place. And it allows me to be responsible and grown up and work through issues. I just think I wish the culture would move along much faster than it has in terms of embracing our inner lives and our needs. And get over all this gunplay that's everywhere, and the violence and the me and the you and the dominance and if more people could explore their psyches and feel great about it and use it almost as therapy or a communication thing, I just think it's such a sad state that, what have you done?
It's not getting better either, I don't think.
Well, a lot of things are really screwed up right now.
And then I used to hate when people would attribute art to violence. You know what I mean? Oh, if you see a Rambo movie, you're going to go kill people. No, you're not. No. If you listen to heavy metal, you're going to take drugs. No, you're not. Those things aren't going to make you do these things.
You're probably feeling violent and then you go look for violence somewhere, or you're probably taking drugs and then you like someone who's like espousing drugs. Like, anyone that thinks that art is starting the pressure is insane. Art is alleviating the pressure.
Absolutely.
Life is starting the pressure.
That I agree. What can I say? But I agree. So you're under lockdown still. You're quarantining, whatever you want to call it. Just you and your son.
Yes.
I would imagine, I don't know about you and we have a much better dialogue with our children than my wife and I had with our parents. Is that the case for you too?
The internet changed everything. Like, as of 2000, everybody had the same access to the same sort of cultural touchstones. Right. We're all absorbing similar, what do you want to call it? A zeitgeist has sort of included. And if I think the people that are older who don't want to engage with that medium.
Yeah.
They feel to me farther away because they're not sort of engaging in the same collective medium. And they feel more, I'm always bugging my mother, please don't ask me how to work your phone at this point.
How old is your mom? How old is your mom?
86, I think.
86, okay. Yeah, my parents are 82. So yeah, they don't even have a computer or a smartphone. So bravo to your mom.
She doesn't want it. She thinks it's incredibly rude. Like, they still don't have a call waiting. They think it's incredibly rude to interrupt a conversation. And I appreciate that more and more. The pandemic has definitely slowed life down.
Right.
And I don't hate that. I do not hate that. Being stuck indoors, I hate.
But we can go. We can
not
go.
Being able to hug people. I don't know. It's worrysome.
What about? But you can go out for a walk. Like we, my wife and I take a.
But I have to walk through the Strand with all these people around here. Masks.
Oh, okay.
So it's like you hold your breath and run through them. I started going really early to the beach, like crazy early.
There you go.
And especially in the beginning of lockdown, I had a whole nocturnal life down at the beach, which, let me tell you, it was hopping down there. I would pass a surfer at 3 a.m. coming up from the water, and I'm like, tip of the hat.
Is it, will this, I can't imagine that the pandemic can affect lyrics in upcoming music.
I don't do that.
You don't do it? Okay.
Thrilled to that. I'm not interested in putting the stuff that I really hate and don't want to think about that I don't feel like benefits me in any way. I don't want to make a lockdown record. I want to make an all-time record.
Gotcha.
Because it's like the same thing. Why don't you make a song about Trump? I don't want to give Trump a song.
No, he doesn't need
a
song.
He doesn't get a song. The virus doesn't get a song. Okay. Not for me.
I was thinking though more like the positives that you were talking about. There are some positives with being like, this is probably the most time you've spent with your son in a couple of years, because as they get older and they go off to college, if he is at college, but now you guys are together and there's probably a lot more conversation. I'm just assuming, because that's how it is in our house.
Yeah. there was a period of time when we were like more butting heads. And then this is just, we're really good. We're a good team. We're a good team for this kind of stuff.
Excellent.
He's a great person.
That's what's great. That's when I feel
he's good. Surpassing me in a lot of ways. It's interesting. This is the age at which he's starting to surpass me. Like, we were working on art and my input was actually making things worse. And when I left the room, it got better. And so I'm like, okay, I get it.
Nice.
Can't really teach you much.
I feel good about the future because of my kids. And when I meet their friends, they seem to have it together. They seem so, you know, when people are like, where's the world headed? I go, I don't know. I'm talking to a lot of kids that, you know, seem positive and they're open to everything. And, so I'm sure
they're
your son's the same way.
They're sensitive to each other. They are opinionated and
they are opinionated.
Like, I can't even wade in those waters.
But when they get off the
phone, socialism comes up and I'm like, okay, let's just dial it down, you know, cause like,
yeah,
they want the world to change and they're not wrong. They want this country to function better and they're not wrong. And it must be incredibly frustrating to look at how old our leaders are.
Oh my God.
And how slowly this country changes. It just must drive them up a wall. I'm used to that. They don't see the sense in it. And I can't argue with that.
We can't even get the leaders to be my age and your age. I mean, I think the leaders are old too. You know,
It was that baby boom, right?
Mm-hmm.
The baby boomers.
Yeah.
The boomers. Like, it's the boom. We heard about this, the white avalanche or tsunami, whatever it was. There was going to be that. I can remember that like in the 90s, they were talking about that. When this generation reaches, you know, 65 and older, there's going to be so many of them. And they're having their moment,
Yeah. You
know, like, but it's so frustrating for the young, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
the young are having to shoulder the burdens of mistakes made by not even the generation above them, but the generation above that.
Right.
And they're looking at a hard road and it's not fair.
No, it's not. And again, I'm a white guy and I hate seeing all these white guys with white hair. It's just like, I'm like, is this it? Is this what we got right now? When is this going to stop? That's why when I see a guy like John Ossoff or Pete Buttigieg, I'm like, they're still guys, but at least they're young. But thank God for Kamala Harris. I mean,
it's a huge, we need to click over many more times in our society at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. What was my next? I got
holiday music.
Holiday music. We can talk about holiday music. Yeah, that's what I threw out to you.
Bait and switch. Were you just telling my manager we were going to talk about holiday music? You didn't really mean it because I would wait for someone to talk to holiday.
I would never promise that and not do it. I do want to give thanks to Taylor Thompson for setting this up.
Yes,
I've been trying to get you on the show for a long time. I know there's a fine line between being persistent and being a nuisance. And I walked that. I was a nuisance. Because
you were a complete nuisance. And you really shouldn't have done that to me because I'm the most, I will dig in the other direction.
That's kind of how, it's funny because.
Opposite and equal reaction. I did warn you.
You did warn me. And
this isn't going to work.
I know, but I just.
But then when you went quiet for a long time, look, here I am.
That's right. Okay. Well, then, okay. So people, if you're listening, that's how Liz Phair operates and she's not lying. So
I always input the information and I put it in the back of my head. I just don't get to it on time.
Right.
But it's always there. Like if I say something, I'm going to do something. It might be 2 years later, but it always happens.
Cool. Well, and that's happening right now. So, okay, Christmas. First of all, are you a big Christmas person? Do you like the holidays?
I do. And I will admit to a sneaky enjoyment of not having the crazy Christmas that we always have. Like, there's a tiny bit of me that feels like I got a year off in a weird way, because at my age, you're the Christmas maker.
Yeah, you have to do it all.
You're not necessarily a Christmas enjoyer. Yeah. Like, you know, I'll come screeching in from a very busy December where, you know, I'm in one now and it's during a pandemic and it's, we're just got to get this done. And then it's time to like put on your, what do they call it? Sally Homemaker outfit and like totally be the hostess or the guest or the, you know, it, my parents come out here and we go to parties and I see friends and there's all these traditions that we are involved in. So there's cooking and there's cleaning and there's, you know, it's just an insane, hectic mess and it's beautiful and it's splashy, but my son and I are really psyched to just kind of like do our own little,
little Christmas.
Yeah, we're planning to Zoom with my parents and do some fun games and like his dad's family. I snuck in on the Zoom Thanksgiving they were doing. And so like there's a lot of missing the people, mm-hmm. but I am kind of thrilled to just be like, don't have to do anything.
What about a Christmas tree? Is there a Christmas tree up in your household?
No. And I thought I bought a tiny little real tabletop one. And mm-hmm. I thought I was so smart, you know, because the trees are a big thing for us and they're always real. And it turned out to be artificial. And I just like collapsed on the floor and practically cried. I was like, and Nick said, he's like, I'll take it. I'll put it in my room. So now he's got like an artificial tabletop tree, but yeah, I was so excited. I would like lie awake at night thinking about this little tree. Like I didn't want to leave it on the stoop too long. It might get hot. It might dry out. Then I had to think about like, where was I going to plant it after Christmas? Like this thing was a live tree. I had thoughts and thoughts and thoughts about this stupid artificial tabletop tree that I thought was real.
Now, where did you buy this tree? Because I can't imagine you thinking this artificial tree was a real tree, though, Liz. It's kind of insane that you thought this artificial tree was a real tree. It must be the best artificial tree ever.
It was from a very swanky home decor site.
Okay.
And I was so excited. A little tiny mini tree.
We always get a real tree. We put it up this weekend. And as we're putting it up, my wife, because our oldest child is in Massachusetts at college and doesn't want to fly home. And we understand. But so it was just my wife and me and our 16-year-old. And as we're putting the tree up, we realized we're the only ones that are going to see this year. Like, that's kind of
sad. But you got to do it if you want to.
I do want it.
Yeah,
we do want it. But I put this train up under the tree, and that's only for when friends come over that have little kids and they play with the train, but there it is. So I guess I'm gonna have to play with it. But it's just it's just like some of the stuff that you just, I'm like, all right, this is just for us this year. So growing up, did you celebrated Christmas? Did you celebrate Hanukkah? I don't know your religious background. I don't know.
I'm Episcopalian, and we celebrated Christmas.
Right.
And actually, now we're segueing, I'm so excited, into Christmas music. I was in the church choir.
Right.
So, and my church celebrated, I can't remember what it was called. It was this crazy Yule banquet.
Okay.
So my church, I was really good friends with the daughter of the reverend, and I still am friends with her, and she was sort of a rambunctious, as sometimes the children of clergy are wont to be.
Yeah, they want to break out.
Yeah, she was super fun. But I was in the choir and we had to dress. This is like when I'm 9 or 10. But there was some banquet, some Yule banquet. I can't remember what it was called. And they'd set up all these banquet tables and it would all be dark lighting, candlelit and everything. We had to make all these wreaths with 4 candles, some Advent, something or other.
Advent wreath.
Probably. And then we had to wear these little felt costumes. Like we wore like red tights and green felt, almost little tiny jester costumes or something. And we had to tumble. You know, we'd like be the, I guess they were recreating a court, like an old English, I guess Episcopalians have that Anglophilia that I carry with me to this day. But we were like the court jesters for the Yule ball, and we would tumble and then sing and then serve. And I can remember walking around. I just loved the atmosphere. I loved sort of time traveling into this mysterious. I love Halloween too. I like any transformative holiday. If it's going to be transformative, I'm all in. So I look at it that way. Like Christmas to me is less about religion and much more about the winter festival and the transformation of that and time traveling back to a time when you'd actually like go out into the middle of the forest on a moonlit night and hang little ornaments on a live tree that you didn't cut down, like any kind of transformative stuff. I am all in.
And so your parents were big into Christmas. Are you from a big family? Do you have siblings?
We're from a medium family. We had a lot of extended family when we lived in Cincinnati, and then everybody dispersed. We moved to Chicago. So then we had a medium family, but like my mom grew up with big, big holidays and many people and like pretty formal. My dad's family was much more informal, but mom had like huge trees that they would cut from their own property and like drag down. And we had a tradition of the kids going to bed on Christmas Eve and then the adults would stay up drinking and decorating the tree. So when we came down, like the house had completely become Christmas.
Oh, that's great.
And the parents would wake up with like the worst hangovers, you know. But they kind of loved it because they'd stay up partying with each other, decorating, and, you know, all the extended family, all the cousins and the grandparents. And what I loved about Christmas especially was how multi-generational it was.
Right.
It was everybody from the young to the old, and we all participated. And my father's mother would make a giant vat of eggnog, which was, I mean, you could have lit it on fire. It was so alcoholic. It was just like a complete. And my other grandmother would make rum balls, these little chocolate rum balls.
I remember rum balls.
I remember we would take these around to neighbors and stuff. Like there was such a pageantry about it.
Yeah.
We did it up. Yeah, but nobody was particularly religious about it. There was always a sort of solemn, quiet Christmas Eve where it was more contemplative. And I try to recreate that. There's sort of a quiet stateliness to Christmas Eve. But Christmas is just chaos. And
when I was a kid, like there's such a buildup because all these emotions and all these things are happening. And then Christmas comes. And then it's just kind of over. And that was always just sad. It's just like, wait a minute. But yesterday, remember we were doing all that fun stuff and everyone was so happy and nice. And now, Christmas is over now.
That's where technology comes in.
Yeah.
That's what I was just talking to my son about this. Gen X really wanted new technology on Christmas. That was a huge thing for us. And that's what you did with your kids. You give them new technology, then you like shuttle them off to go play with that for the week before they're sick of it. So you get this like grace period where the kids have something to do for a week and the parents can collapse and do whatever they need to do.
And would you go see Santa Claus? Would you go sit on the Santa's lap and ask for gifts? Was that part of the thing or you didn't do that?
Did you do that?
Yeah, we would go. I don't know what age that stopped. I mean, I can't recall doing it after 10, but I was from a very small town in Pennsylvania, like 5,000 people. So it's like very, so yeah, we did a lot.
Everybody, and it was a tradition. Everyone joined
it. Yeah. And we would do a lot of stuff longer than normal people might at that age. Like, I think I trick-or-treated when I was a senior in high school because there was nothing else to do. There was, I mean, the closest city was Pittsburgh and that was 2.5 hours away. So, I mean.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you were in a rural
absolutely,
area.
Absolutely. My wife always says.
So special. Knowing everybody makes that kind of like winter holiday.
Yeah, unless you don't care for those people.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's true.
I certainly don't care for them now with the election and you find out where people stand. But yeah, as a kid, we didn't know anything. So that was cool. So was there Christmas music in the house?
Always. And it would start. Mom always cooked to classical music. So that was on every day of the year.
Okay.
Like it would always be classical music during dinner. Dad would come in with like Django Reinhardt or something. He had more of an eclectic taste. Mm-hmm. He liked jazz. He liked stuff he could bop to that wasn't too risky.
What do you mean not too risky?
I'm trying to think like what he was a little more worldly with his music. Like it was, well, that's not the right word. Edgier.
Okay.
A little edgier with his music. But they had, you know, I was very young when I heard Bob Dylan and Jesus Christ Superstar and like for my parents being not at all hippie, they had some current stuff. I mean, I definitely Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel and Joan Baez, and they had sort of the 70s classics. Music was a huge part of our life. Like my mother would always, we'd go to a midnight service just for the music. Like she was, it was less about, it's so weird because we did attend church, but they were intellectual. They were kind of like, well, you know, these things are hard to define. Like they were not religious. In fact, I always would take communion and they wouldn't. And I'd be like, why are you not taking communion? They're like, well, you know what I mean? But the community of church and the music, oh my God, my mom would find the best music in the area and we'd go hear like lessons and carols, or she's still into it. Music was a huge part of my growing up and they had excellent taste in music and they still do. It's still a big part of us. I don't think we ever eat without music.
Yeah. Go, and are you playing Christmas music at the house? Currently, do you play Christmas music?
Not currently, but something's wrong. I have to get my Sonos rehooked up. But I brought some of our little classics. I was thinking you were going to ask. Like,
yeah, let's see it.
Like, you can't not have Burl Ives. You got to have that on at some point. But like, I was thinking about the songs that really, contemporary ones.
See, I get this.
You got to have Nat King Cole.
We got Burl Ives on this. This is
yeah, you
got
to have a Burl Ives.
Yeah, we got Burl Ives on that one.
Is that your touchstone?
No, you know, the album that was big for my family was the Nat King Cole Christmas album.
Nat King Cole, 100%. That's us.
I actually purchased that last Christmas on vinyl, and it came on green vinyl. So, yeah, that was always a go-to, and it... you know, when you grow up with something, it just gets in your DNA and that's still my go-to. I love it.
You have to have Donny Hathaway this Christmas.
Yes.
I have to hear the Pogues, Fairy Tale of New York. I have to hear the Pretenders, 2000 Miles. Bowie and Bing Crosby. That was a pretty good one. The Little Drummer Boy.
That was a great one because your parents were sounds like a little more eclectic than my parents, but my parents could get into the Bing and Bowie because they liked Bing. And then my brother and, you know, the younger people liked the Bowie. So that was a nice meshing for everybody at Christmas. But
there's always in a stocking for me, there's always mom's new favorite symphony, like, I don't know, like the Cambridge Orchestra will do Christmas. And it's all very, one of the things I wanted to say about Christmas music that's really important to me and plays heavily into my career is that I started writing songs on guitar to write a Christmas carol. I wanted to write an original Christmas carol. That's literally why I started making up my own songs. So I would get to have colored lights in my room at home when I was young. And that's what I thought would be the best thing to do with this guitar. You know, the lessons that I was taking were kind of boring. So I wanted to make up my own Christmas carol. And the church choir also. So like Christmas music is way more in my DNA than anyone would like to admit. And I think what Christmas music is really about, and I would take this broader and say holiday music, including all the religions, it's the human voice. It's the time for the human voice. It's the most, you know, that's when you sing, is around your winter holidays because dark, it's deep, and there's something moody about it. And I love that about the holidays, like deep, that sense of like, even if it's imaginary, heavy snow. I do this thing, and I don't know if anyone ever does this, but here in California, I think you'll enjoy this if you ever want to try it. Open up a bunch of YouTube tabs on your laptop while you're working and create a little sonic environment for yourself. You can get like 2 hours of just wind, and then you can get 2 hours of like crunching through a forest in the snow. And then you can play your favorite music underneath this sort of tableau. You can have a crackling fire going on.
So you're saying play all these at one time together.
At one time. And you're not even looking at it. It's just background. I create these little winter tableau scenes.
That is interesting.
It's great. I mean, you can do it with rain at different times of the year. You can do it with all sorts of sounds, but you can create a whole sonic landscape that I find very holiday-ish You know, I do whatever one I want. I do multiple. I usually have about four or five going at once, and they're ambient soundscapes, and I create whatever mood I want, and then I play the music of my choice on top of that.
Gotcha. Okay, that's cool. I like that. That's interesting. I would have never thought to do that. That's interesting. How did you, what made you think of this?
I love sound. I love sound more than I can possibly explain. I had poor eyesight when I was young. And so like the sound world feels very, very real to me. And I like to create soundscapes.
So do you have a sound machine at night when you're sleeping? Do you have one of those things?
On the road, I do.
Okay. But if at home.
Well, okay. Here's a good holiday thing. When everybody's in the dang house and they're all getting up at different hours, having coffee or doing whatever they're doing, or someone wants to walk to town to get an actual paper or whatever is going on. Cause we like to do the crosswords together, like we'll Xerox it and then, or, you know, print it now, but like everyone gets the Sunday New York Times and who can finish it first. But with all this activity and I'm so sound sensitive, I just have to like earplug it up and white noise it up. And I'm just always like grumbling like, oh God, I can hear everybody. You know,
what, when you were growing up, how did Christmas presents work? Did you ask for things and get them, or did your parents want to surprise you with things? Cause that's, like our kids are like, give us a list. And I'm just like, this isn't, I want to surprise you with something. I just don't want to fulfill your list. You know what I mean? You know, that doesn't
seem. Don't you find it dismaying that they never particularly like what you surprise them with? They're like, oh, thanks.
Well, that is true too. So there is something about just, but it's just so impersonal. Just, it's like, here it is. And then you check it off and order it.
Nick's
and
father and I have put all of that feeling into the ugly Christmas sweater, and we swap years who gives him the ugly Christmas sweater. This year it's my year, and I'm thrilled. I'm so excited about it. I can't wait till he opens it. But we just get him what he wants now, because it, I mean, I probably did what you did. Mm-hmm. How old are your kids?
16 and 20.
Oh no, I'd given it up by then.
Okay.
By then I was getting them what they wanted. There's always stupid stuff to embarrass them that I like to give.
Right.
Like silly things. There's always silly stuff. And my parents love to do the silly stuff. And his dad's family does too. So there's always got to be that whimsy. But it was a long spell of, I feel like from 8 to 15, where he'd say thank you and he really didn't like it, you know, even extravagant things. Like one year when he was young, I got him the robotic R2-D2 that was supposed to go around and do things to command and talk to you. And I think that like sat in his closet for, you know,
that's a bummer too. When you look at the thing you purchased and they're not playing with it.
He just wanted Legos. So we just got him Legos. We got him what he wanted. And there was, he's not, yeah, I don't know. I couldn't figure out what he wanted.
And what does he get you? What kind of stuff is mom getting?
He gets me great gifts. He gets me little thoughtful things that are pretty. Like one year that I still have in the living room, it was, what do you call those glass balls with stuff inside them?
Snow globe.
It's a snow globe, but it's not. It has sand and seashells and like waves sort of blown into the glass. Or one time he got me a Harry Potter plaque that someone had painted that I still have up. Like he got me a little tiny Robert Pattinson book when I was into Twilight
okay.
1 year ago as a joke. But he's more thoughtful than I am. He listens to the little things that I absolutely love. Like for my birthday this year, he got me two super dark 99 proof chocolate bars. And then he created a whole clue based treasure hunt for me to find these. It was very fun.
That's pretty great.
He's really thoughtful.
So where's he getting this thoughtfulness from? Is he getting it from mom or is he getting it from dad? Who's the thoughtful person?
Take the village, Pat. I don't know, because I can be abrupt and impatient. So like he got it somewhere.
Christmas specials. Did you watch the Christmas specials when you were a kid? Rudolph, the Grinch.
Of course. Heat Miser.
Yes.
One time on the card, we dressed Nick up with like he was in the White House hallway right by the Rose Garden. You know, that colonnade.
Yes.
With the things, he was in a black blazer. I think he was going to dancing school back then because he had a black blazer. And he was looking very official in the White House hallway. You know, this is a Photoshop game. And then with Heat Miser and Cold Miser behind him, mm-hmm. they were having a summit. I love that stop animation.
I do too. They don't do that anymore.
No, they don't.
The thing about Christmas music is, too, it's you only listen to it like from Thanksgiving through maybe New Year's Eve. And then you don't listen to that any other time of the year. There's no other music that's like that. Like, you don't say, like, well, I only listen to Led Zeppelin in March. I mean, there's no, you know what I mean? It's nothing like that. So that's another thing. It's like a special, it's special music because it's specifically, yes, it's specifically for this time of year.
It isn't just like, you know, you have a couple songs for 4th of July or you have a couple songs for Thanksgiving, like We Gather Together or something. Like holiday music is vast and deep.
Yeah,
like
there's tons of it.
There's tons of it and there's excellent stuff. Like those Winterscapes I was talking about with the tabs, the open tabs of YouTube. Sometimes I like a moody Christmas music. I like the fun stuff when you're cooking in the kitchen with everybody.
Right.
But the private sort of music I listen to when I'm chilling out from all the people are things like, do you know about that TED talk by Eric Whitaker when he did the virtual choir?
I do not. Tell me.
I think it was 2011. He was a composer, a classical composer for voice. So many, many voices at once, which I love. And he had people from all over the world. He gave them what I would call the stems, like the soprano part, the alto part, like all the different parts. And then this editor cut them all together. So they would film themselves on their laptop performing their part.
Okay.
And then someone collated it and lined it all up and treated it until you could literally see all the different faces from all across the world in this stunning, there's this one called Lux Arum, Arumke, Lux Arumke, I think it's like light and gold. And it's just stunning. And you feel transported, or like sometimes like the Russian Orthodox male choirs, you know, that do the chorals and stuff. Like I'll put that in my Winterscape. There's so many moody, deep, profound kind of feeling musical pieces associated with holidays. And it may be a narrow window of time, but you can go deep. You can go into the past. You can do stuff that's super modern. It's such a fat avenue of play.
And I do like when some of my favorite artists do manage to record a great Christmas album. Like I love James Taylor. He has a great Christmas album. I really like, it's very pretentious, but I love Sting's Christmas album.
I don't know that one. I don't know Sting's Christmas album.
It's on a winter's night.
Awesome. Perfect.
Yeah, there's songs just like Soul Cake and Christmas at Sea and Now Winter Comes Slowly. It's songs I've never heard before. And pardon me?
Are they original or are they covers?
I think some are originals, but I think most of them are like really, really, like really old. Really old stuff. Yeah.
He loves that stuff, doesn't he? He goes back to the folk.
Get that. Pick that one up. Now, you talked about wanting to write a Christmas song when you were a kid. Do you think we'll ever get, not an album, but maybe a Liz Phair Christmas song? Do you ever think about that?
I've forgotten about it. I've stopped trying. It was much harder than I thought. You couldn't.
But now you're more accomplished now than you were at 10, 11, or 12.
I did do a good one for Amazon Music a couple of years ago. I guess it was like 5 years ago now, mm-hmm. called Ho Ho Ho, which I'm very proud of. It was a little bit punky. You should check that out on Amazon.
I will check that out.
And I inverted it. Like we were having this like completely poor, poverty stricken like holiday. But it was still like a great one anyway. It's great. It's like, we don't have a fire. We're watching it on TV, or like we don't have stockings. We have socks. Our house is the dimmest one on the block. Like that's not Santa's sleigh jingling on the rooftop. That's the landlord changing the locks. You know, like we had so much fun making that one. So I have done a Christmas song.
Okay.
And I played it on the Amy Mann and Ted Leo Christmas tour. The whole band played it with me.
But is that on iTunes? Is that somewhere where we can buy that, or we just have to find
Amazon
it?
Amazon Music. Yeah, you can buy it on Amazon Music.
All right. Well, people go buy that. I'll look for that. I'm bummed that I didn't know that.
I'm on here to plug my Christmas song, but I actually have a Christmas song.
Well, that's okay, because you're here, so plug it. Do you have, are there any decorations up at your home right now?
Yes, there are wreaths. There is one. I got one balcony done with the red ribbon and the lights.
Okay.
But I'm waiting for the other. I got 2020'd on the ribbon situation. Like, you know, it's delayed. We're sorry, it's canceled. So waiting on that. We'll do what we want. This is the holiday where we're going to do exactly what we want and nothing that we don't. And that's the Christmas to me.
I love that. We'll do what we want.
We'll do what we want, damn it. But I don't know. I feel maybe this is a female thing. Women really get hit hard at Christmas. We're the worker bees. Like, we're really like busting ass over the holiday.
Well,
at least I am. I feel like I don't sit down, and I'm not even kidding, for 10 days. So I finish work and then I don't even sit down. And it's like morning to night. Like all the stuff, all the people, the lunches, all the dinners. It's just a lot.
Well, at my house, people who know us, it's no secret. My wife makes way more money than me. So I do.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I do all the Christmas stuff, though. Like, I wrap all the presents, put up all the lights, lug the tree in. I mean, it's not like she doesn't help. She does when she's free from work. But yeah, I do all the stuff. And then she comes out and says, "This looks so nice. You do such a great job." So, and I don't mind doing it. I kind of like doing it because I grew up and my mom would bake. I swear my mom would bake like 300 Christmas cookies, like 12 different kinds, like all these different Christmas cookies. And I was raised in a big Christmas household. It was a big deal. Do you remember when you were a kid, what was one of the best Christmas presents maybe that you ever got?
Atari.
Oh, wow. That is a good one.
Light Bright. Walkman, big ones. One time my parents splurged because I'd been a very, very good girl. This is adult life. And they gave me like a small trip. Sometimes my mom gets me like great boots.
That's a good one.
Jewelry always works. Jewelry's a go-to. I haven't really I'm due for jewelry, although I did get some jewelry, but anything that feels unusual, like anything that you really want. I mean, I don't even know if I know when it's coming. I don't know when a good Christmas is coming or a bad Christmas is coming.
You don't know. That's true.
I'm like, it's it's hit and miss.
What about, I see guitars behind you. What about a guitar? Is that a good gift if someone surprises you with a new guitar?
No, that
you don't really
work.
Want that. That's work. Okay.
No, I like the holiday to be not intruded upon by work. I like it to be a step into a separate kind of life.
So
you know what I mean?
So you're totally not in any type of work mode right now. You are just.
Oh no, I am. Oh, yeah. Friday should be the end of it, but it has been a hell of a fall. So yeah, no, we're kind of losing it, but I'm starting to slow down a little bit.
All right. Is there going to be now, cause I had heard that there might be a sequel to Horror Stories. Is there another?
There is.
And that's a definite. There always was. So when you signed your book deal, it was for two books,
Horror Stories, Fairy Tales.
And why separate them instead of releasing like a massive Keith Richards style book?
Well, because I didn't want to do it just about my life. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write actual like semi-literature with it, about something that everyone can relate to. I don't walk around. I think this is unusual about me. I don't walk around feeling like a rock star.
You don't seem like that either. You're not giving me any of that right now.
I tried it. I did that for a while. I wasn't a pleasant human being. I became like Veruca Salt or something. Like, it was not a good mode for me. And I also couldn't write songs because I think as an artist, I was a visual artist before I was a musical artist. So that's more hardwired in my DNA to be like an artist. Doesn't matter the medium. And I like to be the observer.
Okay.
more than I like to be the observed. Now, don't I love a good photo shoot or video because then I'm making the art somehow, but it's got to involve making the art. If we're not making art of some kind, I'm not particularly interested.
Gotcha.
And it just, for me, it's fun to just transform. Holidays come, you're a totally different person.
And what about if you're on the street and you get recognized? How do you handle that? Do you get recognized? I would assume yes.
I mean, in other cities, way more than here, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I get it all the time in New York and Chicago, or even London, like in other cities like Seattle, San Francisco, I get recognized. I do not get recognized here. And maybe because there's so many stars here.
Yeah, maybe because it's old hat here, too. You're like, yeah.
And my early career didn't impact L.A. as much. Mm-hmm. L.A. was not like a central market for me. I was an East Coast, Midwest artist.
So what brought you to California then? And this feels like this is where you're going to...
What brought me to California?
Well, okay. So it was just that it was strictly weather-based.
With weather and the creativity that I felt, like there was a point at which I was successful in Chicago where people kind of hated me for it. There was a sense that I'd taken too much of the share of my pie,
mm-hmm.
or the overall pie, that there wasn't that much creative industry in Chicago, and any one person that got too big started to take shots.
Okay.
You know, people were taking shots at you for that.
And it's just, that's just jealousy.
It's also desperation because it's mostly a business town. It's an arts appreciating town.
Right.
But I don't, the arts community has that big of the economic pie graph.
Right. I should say it was, that sounds like unwarranted jealousy.
It's the circumstance, yeah. And I couldn't deal with that. I don't have patience for that. It wasn't easy for me,
mm-hmm.
the way people think it was.
Yeah.
None of this career has been easy. And I think because I did get a couple breaks that I didn't totally deserve, like I was cute, I was a female, it was unusual what I was doing, I had provocative lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was easy for people to say like, she didn't have to, you know, pay her dues, trust me. Did still like it's not easy. So to be in an environment, especially because I was a visual artist before and I've always been interested in writing, where you don't have to just be an indie rocker or just be this or that. Los Angeles has a creative community stemming from film, you know, much bigger industries, the advertising, the gaming,
right,
porn, whatever, like big entertainment industry here means spillover.
Yeah.
You can compose for television. You could write there's just a lot of lateral movement.
Yeah.
Possible and here.
That kind of thing is ridiculous, jealousy type thing in people, because first of all, you were born a woman. You can't help if you're cute. I mean, these are things are you supposed to not pursue your passion just because you're cute and a woman? That's stupid. I hate it.
I don't think that they were mad at me for pursuing a passion. I think they were bitter that when the powers that be came in and selected who they were going to mm-hmm. give contracts to, that's when I think the bitterness came in. And for a while, I think 10 years after Guyville, I felt weird about that and upset that they had treated me that way. And then now I actually see more their side of it. I see the view of it is hard in an area where you don't have as many opportunities for as many people. And to be working at it a long time and then some chick, they didn't know me. They didn't know that I had been writing songs since I was in eighth grade. They didn't know mm-hmm. the art career I had at Oberlin. I just waltz into Wicker Park and next thing you know, I've got a big contract, you know?
That's how it happens sometimes.
That's how it happens.
That's how it happens.
It isn't necessarily right. You know what I mean? And it isn't, I don't deny myself anything that I got. I just think that I have so much more understanding and empathy for what it meant to them at the time to feel passed over unfairly and to feel that yet again, the major labels were doing up to no good, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to think like maybe a label person would. And if I want to have a diverse roster on my label and I'm looking around and you've got the goods, then why am I not going to sign you? You know what I mean? If you want to have,
it's an and, not an or.
Right.
You know, like it makes perfect sense. I would sign me too.
Yeah.
But it's also about a whole scene of community. Like what the thing was in Wicker Park, and I think this is what they resented, is that, and Steve Albini helped me understand this, it was a community that helped each other. They helped each other. They had developed an intertwining web of like helping each other tour, helping each other record, helping each other with their jobs so they could survive. There was a real community, which I sort of skated into unaware of the deeper bonds and the deeper ties.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, did whatever I normally do. And it felt like I had been selected from the scene that they had built for so long. Mm-hmm. Without having put into the scene, without having laid down those roots or supported that scene. And then I just fucked off to New York or wherever I went, you know, like, so I get it. But from my point of view also, it wasn't that really. My story is different than the story they're telling themselves. And I think everybody understands that it's water under the bridge now, but you know, at the time I didn't get it. At the time they didn't get it. And now we all get it.
Yeah. Well, I hope we get it.
I hope we get it.
Yeah. My background is stand-up comedy. So that was the same. I started in Chicago and that was the same way. Someone would come in who was the new face. He wasn't any better or worse than you, but he was new and they would get some attention. So that's just how it is. Don't get into show business and expect it to just,
right. It's not,
there's
yeah.
no, there's, think, there's no book.
The Wicker Park music scene was anti show business.
Okay.
And I was pro show business. And I think that also rankled them.
Like, why wouldn't you be? If you want to get in, if that's what you want your vocation to be, then you have to be pro show business.
I don't know. I mean, I really do see it from their point of view. I do. And I think there's a scene in LA that I love that I found through other friends, like a whole music scene in LA of people that support each other and keep each other afloat and care about each other and throw gigs each other's way, you know. Those kind of webs are vital for artists. Vital.
Yeah.
And at the time, at the age of 25, 26, was I caring about that? No, not at all. You know?
And you should.
In New York for visual artists. I'd been at Oberlin, like writing songs and doing visual. Like I had a whole different take on it. And we just happened to clash in terms of what our perception was.
Well, I'm interviewing you, not any, none of them. good for you.
I'm not saying I didn't have the talent. I did. I'm just saying there was a misunderstanding and I could have been more sensitive to where I was and what I was. Yeah.
I'm sad that you still think about it. It seems like you still do think about it though.
Because as the older I get, the more I see what is beneath the things that we take for granted, the more I understand the value of, I've been through more hard times. I've been in circumstances where I watch their community and think I could never be totally a part of it because I'm just not a joiner like that. I'm a lone whatever. I mean, that's what people know me for. Like she sort of did it her own way.
Yeah.
And that plays into your social life too. Like, but I'm the kind of person that has like one really good friend in all these different social scenes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
like
I can be part of scenes and I can go and know everybody, but I'm never the ones on the deep email thread because that requires responsibility to that scene. That becomes a membership thing that sort of you become part of a large family. And that always, you know, I just want to do art.
Yeah. That's a lot of work and a lot of hassle sometimes too.
But I see the beauty in it. It's its own art piece. Having a community like that around art is its own art piece.
Okay.
To create that community is a work of art.
But you, living in LA for 20 years now, you feel like you have some of that.
Yes. Good. Yes. And this time I appreciate it and I understand it and I'm respectful of it.
Terrific.
But I'm still off doing my own crazy shit. Like I'm going to write a book. It's my joy. I mean, my mom says this all the time. Whenever I go through tough times, she's like, you never reach a higher high than when you're making art that you really love and you feel like it's really, like, there is no higher high for me. And it shows in my personal life. Like, that is that is where I feel like I'm touching the heavens. I feel like I'm transcending my small 70 plus year life. You know, like that's where the addiction is yeah. to feel like that art is really happening. Can you hear my stomach growling? I really hope you can't.
I can't.
You probably can.
When I listen back, though, I'll strain to listen to it. Well, that's good for your mom. That's good for your mom to tell you that. That's good. That's some good parenting. So you go, Mom.
Go, Mom.
So, Liz, this has been really fun for me to talk to you. And I hope when your next project comes out that you will come back and we can really dig in to your catalog of music. Because I got all these notes that keeping. And
sorry.
And no, it's cool. I want when you come back.
Is there anything from that you really just want an answer from that's very specific?
No. Because I enjoyed this. I enjoyed this friendly conversation about growing up and Christmas and a little bit about your career. But we'll take I'd love to take a deep dive, and I'm not going to put you on the spot to promise me that. But I would love to take a deep dive when the next book comes out or new music comes out. I would love to do that because I'm a big fan. I will tell you, White Chocolate Space Egg, I don't think it's due. I think that's such a good record. And I just want to talk about that the next time. So hopefully you'll want to do that. You'll see the value in this.
I tend to get smarter the older I get. So that's a good bet. So thank you for your patience and thank you for your good humor in so this
sort of. Of course. Now, I usually end the show with a playout song. So it's usually a song by the artist, but I'll play whatever song you want.
Do Ho Ho Ho.
Okay. I'll find Ho 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 and that'll be our playout song.
Okay, great.
Okay. Liz, I wish you and Nick and anyone you come in contact with via Zoom over the holidays. I want you all to have great holiday season. And I thank you so much for doing this. And that's it.
Thank you.
Take care. And this is where we wave awkwardly. We wave.
Okay.
And then I end it. Bye, Liz Phair.
Have fun with the trains.
Thanks.
2020.
Christmas. All I got was some coal and some switches. Ours is the dimmest house on the block. They're hanging stockings and we're hanging socks. Doing shots of room temperature, peppermint schnapps, as the U-log on TV crackles and pops. They had to cut back on most of the staff. Santa's a joker and I need a laugh.
Still, I believe in the spirit of forgiveness. Oh.